Hello, Mage fans, and welcome to Mage the podcast that works hard towards ascension so you don't have to. I'm your host, Adam Simpson. I'm joined again by co-host Terry Robinson. We're going to bring you another episode of Tomes of Magic. In our last episode, we were talking about interest rates and high finance. So, of course, we were talking about Mage the Ascension. This time, we're going to change it up a bit. We're going to talk about aliens, spaceships, and laser guns. So, of course, we're talking about Mage the Ascension. I believe it was Terry who said that Mage the Ascension is not a genre. However, it has a way of pulling all genres into itself. On today's episode, we are going to be talking about the Void Engineers. But before we get into it, I'm going to open it up for announcements. And, you know, I have an announcement. Terry and I have both really enjoyed bringing you episodes of Tomes of Magic. But I've had a few changes in my own personal life. And also, as we look at the Mage 20 books, which we will be doing after the revised edition books, there are some heavy books in there. The page count goes up a bit, giving us lots of great mage content. And because of that, it's going to be a lot easier for us to bring you Tomes of Magic episodes once a month rather than every 2 weeks, just to account for all of that material that we are going to be reading through and keeping notes on. So I just wanted to let everybody know. And Terry, were there any other announcements?
Nope, we will be doing M20 next. We had originally talked about it around the idea of being sorcerer being the next line that we discussed. Adam and I had a conversation. We're like, hey, there may be big changes in both of our lives going forward. We really want to make sure that M20 happens. So we are prioritizing that. If we get through M20 and we both find that we still have free time and spare processor cycles, as it were, to do this, we're going to certainly circle back and cover all of the historical settings. But first, we're going to prioritize the M20 stuff, and we're going to be doing that monthly. My current plan is to continue with weekly episodes, if that still proves to be reasonable. I have some ideas on how to fill that in. If you have any ideas on what you would like to see done, by all means, drop us a note, magethepodcast@gmail.com, or in Discord, discord.me/magethepodcast. There'll be a channel that I set up for Tomes of Magic ideas, and we have a bunch of things that we're batting around. If it proves that we do 3 episodes in a month rather than 4, I will be using that time for other mage-related projects. So regardless, that time will be dedicated towards things that involve the big purple. I don't have any other things to note, except for to say this is the last episode we are recording in 2021, and it's been a heck of a year. We did 26 books in 52 weeks, and I couldn't be happier with that.
Yeah, certainly. I hope we've given our listeners something they enjoyed listening to, but I certainly enjoyed recording it. So even if the listeners are giving it a thumbs down, I had a great time. Okay, well, taking a look at Void Engineers Convention Book Revised. This came out in 2013. It clocks in at 106 pages because Void Engineers don't follow the rules. And of course, I'm referring to the fact that in revised edition, almost every tradition book and convention book was exactly 100 pages. This book had 5 authors all working together to bring it to us, and think it's time to roll into a walkthrough.
The prologue is entitled Blast Off, and starts with headers indicating that something's about to happen, T-minus 76 minutes. It involves a group of BDC officers that are killing something in the sewers of a new city that has been created in Outer Mongolia. There is a firefight, there are big tubes, plasma grenades are thrown, and it introduces one of the largest changes to happen in the revised setting. That is on page 6. It includes art in a prelude, which has happened before. Fallen Tower Las Vegas did it, but it's exceedingly rare. So I was immediately on high alert. I thought this introductory fiction, which ultimately ended with a rocket launch to try and hit a opening in, I think, the Avatar Storm, I thought it was good. It was great at describing things. It had good pacing, and it did the thing that everything in the Void Engineers needs to do to indicate kind of this sense of why they do things, and as well as the pull between we are a crew, but we must act as individuals. I thought it was well written and, on the whole, enjoyable. Did you have any thoughts about the prelude?
Well, I also enjoyed the prelude, but yeah, I'm ready for the intro.
The introduction is entitled To Boldly Fight, and it starts off with saying, we're not going anywhere. It sets up the Void Engineer antagonists, as opposed to being other people within the technocracy, as being otherworldly terrors that, for some reason that we eventually get, cannot be fought with the technocracy as a whole, that they have hope because of mortal interest in science and space, but that hope is kind of diminishing. The theme they list is that they are hardening under pressure. They have lost Tsetse. Their leadership is gone. Tycoides hasn't been heard from, and that they have become a military organization with a civilian branch, where previously they were a civilian organization with a military branch. This was caused by the dimensional anomaly. They have been back-footed, and currently they are trading hope for survival. The mood they list is secrets and pain. Every convention has secrets hidden from each other, as is the nature of a vast conspiracy. Theirs are the fact that there are things beyond the Earth that could destroy it. And again, the question is, the Void Engineers are a conspiracy within a vast conspiracy of the technocracy. Why can't they share it? So hopefully that will be brought up. It includes a note that says, this is a love letter to Mage the Ascension fans that have kept the torch alive. And just to note, when this book was coming out, Mage the Ascension wasn't that far from being kickstarted, and Werewolf the Apocalypse had already finished its Kickstarter process. So I'm always tickled that the 20th anniversary lines and the revised lines overlap with each other. And then it leads on to chapter one. Adam, did you have any thoughts about the introduction?
Well, when looking at the introduction, the thing that stood out to me was they are making a conscious statement here that the youthful idealism that the Void Engineers had in the past has been replaced with a hardened resolve in the face of adversity. At first, I was a little sad because I liked that exuberance and idealism of the old Void Engineers. But looking at Revised Edition, this new approach really does fit in Revised Edition. So I can see why they did it. It makes sense in that context.
Chapter one is entitled A Brief History of Prime. And the chapter opening art I thought was interesting in that we ultimately find out that this is the Wall, a installation at Yamazish Station that I found out later is named after the Yoruban god of water. So that is where Yamazha comes from. And there are a whole bunch of related words. We had a discussion in the Discord about, hey, this is how it spread out into these other belief systems in terms of what is being said. But we get this excerpt from the Wall, which is a kind of memorial to all the people that were lost during the dimensional anomaly. The section opens with a graphic description of what it was like when the dimensional anomaly hit. One of the things that we don't get a lot of information about is how it appeared. And the section says, those who made it out tell strange stories of watching comrades ripped apart as though by invisible claws, of holes melting like crayons in a stove, microsingularities causing people to collapse in on themselves, marines falling over as though dead but hearts still beating. And those are the saner stories. It now also introduces the idea that the Dimensional Science Evaluation Administration and Training Committee has given way to the Existential Threats Directorate, that now on an ongoing basis, they vote every few years to confirm that this is still how they want to do things. The other key thing that they do is they indicate that the convention as a whole has a different spread of membership than a lot of others. They talk about how the incoming class of recruits, which is going to be a fair percentage of the Void Engineers, quite simply, because as they said, in 99, they lost half their membership or more. They say that their 37% are Chinese, probably 50% by the end of the decade. Another 10% are from other Asian areas. 16% are Arabic, 9% are South American, and only about 3 are from Africa, but not for lack of trying. And it makes an interesting note that it says the Syndicate seems pretty damn good at snapping up all the enlightened Africans it can, which echoes the statement in the Syndicate thing that says we are being much more aggressive in recruiting outside of the traditional strongholds of North America and Asia, and especially in the developing world. So we kind of get a snapshot of this is a group that is quite simply different in terms of ethnic makeup than the other ones that have been listed before. It indicates that the new Void Engineers are a machine. It is a war machine, and they may be more organized than the iterators in terms of structures of command. The gauntlet is harder now, but there is a new threat in the form of Threat Null, which we'll get to in a little bit, that seems almost human in its interest in controlling reality. They are concerned that the other conventions feel that since they've won the Ascension War, that they can turn the knives inward, as it were, and hunt internally for dissidents. And they're like, this is the worst idea. And then we get a section of jargon. It's been a while since we've gotten a good meaty section on vocabulary and such.
Yeah, this glossary section impressed me. There have been a few mage books where they add it sort of, I guess, for color. And as you're reading through the book, if you hit a word you don't know, you go back to the glossary. It's like, yeah, it's not helping. But with this book, it really was different. There were a number of times when I was reading through this book, later chapters, and I hit an abbreviation or some special, you know, oddball word. I was like, what is this? I went back to the glossary. Oh, there it is. Okay, thanks. So this glossary was really useful. Very appropriate. Yeah.
I'm not sure how I feel about its usefulness, where I'm like, maybe just things that make more sense would be useful. But even though a lot of them are game terms, it gives you a lot of information about how the group thinks. Like, two early entries are absolutely sure, where it says an educated guess, a good enough idea that you're comfortable sending out someone else. And then later they have a definition. It's like pretty sure. And they're like, no, this is confirmed and tested. And I will go there for myself. And then BDO, big dumb object, a large, impressive and mysterious artificial void object. Examples include traditional chantries, the old cop, arch scientists built dimensional anomaly engines. And one of the things this book is, it just absolutely drips with flavor throughout. And I think the section does a good job of reiterating that. The book is also pretty good that the first time in a chapter that it uses a particular abbreviation, it will expand it out, which I certainly appreciated. The next section they have is a history section. And this is a pretty fascinating one because it almost goes back to like second edition tradition books in terms of being very vague until it decides to be very specific. It says the early void engineers were anyone who went somewhere and mapped it. They knew they would encounter strange things. Sometimes they found other explorers, but regardless, they returned changed. The other half of what would eventually become the void engineers were the celestial masters who mapped and charted the skies. They referred to the path among the stars as the ruined road, and it had many branches. They also point out that neither of these, that unusual among Order of Reason groups at the time, is they were not entirely male. They had a fair amount of non-male and female representation, and they also call out the Kosians as being another group that was like that. They waged a secret war via the House of Selene to kind of clean up heaven as they went, and they're like, the rest of the technocracy doesn't need to know about that. The idea being, if other groups found out how dangerous space and the other worlds were, then maybe it would be difficult to get other groups on board in exploring and exploiting them. As the house that most pushed wonder, their expansion of scientific knowledge made the scourge that held them back more pronounced, which is to say, during the Sorcerer's Crusade era, we refer to paradox as scourge, and they say the fact that they advanced scientific knowledge so much helped firm reality to the point where their own effects were being affected by paradox, that they had the science that they were handing off to mortals, but they were also more remote things. Their own advance of their paradigm was getting in the way of. And they were often involved in colonial violence, that they're like, hey, whenever we cut a path to a new place, others are going to follow. We feel bad about what we did, but what are you going to do? And they had the line that where they led somewhere, disease, violence, and tragedy followed. So they recognized their past harms and seemingly have come to terms with that. In 1452, heliocentrism is proven by Copernicus, or at least that's what they list. And then in some point in the 1700s, Tychoides ascends to being one of the old masters, one of the leaders of the technocracy who kind of guides the convention from there. They claim the true Ascension War didn't start at Mistridge, but when Reginald Proctor built a banking house where Mistridge stood. This was in 1704. The traditions consider this a blasphemy. And in 1745, the White Tower of Languedoc was destroyed. And that is where they put the start of the Ascension War. I like that. I am personally a fan of, I like having the Ascension conflict starting much more recently, because that gives you a broad swathe of history where you're not necessarily sure what's going to happen and people could rub shoulders without difficulty. In terms of secret history, in 1892, they landed on the moon. In 1893, they found Autochthonia after rounding the sun. These are things that if you're interested in more on this, look at Victorian Mage. And then they talk about the effects of the first two world wars on the development of the convention. During World War II, there was a space battle that mirrored the ground battle as strange forces were able to step through the thinning walls of reality, gateways open to strange places. And while the other conventions fought a ground war, they fought a space war. Around the same time, starting a little bit before the turn of the 20th century, they started the Chrononauts Initiative. Around the time of the Grand House Cleaning, which is to say in the 1890s, there was a movement to monitor the time stream called the Temporal Concord. It was dismantled in 1912 for being too dangerous. It dabbled in time travel. This group was ultimately reformed during World War II, and there is kind of the secret history within the secret history that says the group made a number of useful predictions in trying to anticipate Nafandi actions. They say they merely looked forward in time, but they probably actually experienced true time travel. Of the original 20 involved, only 7 survived, and 2 wrote a paper arguing that it was important to explore the Everett volumes that cut across layers of reality and times, what we otherwise refer to as mirror zones. They considered it a new front that they would need to protect Earth from. This group was downgraded over time, and ultimately they disappeared in 1989. Zimmerman and Yardley are the 2 key figures listed in this. So if you want yet another front in the Ascension War, time travelers! After World War II, they didn't really anticipate the space race because it wasn't born, what they said, out of human curiosity. The Cold War made recruiting hard, as void engineers kind of came from everywhere. The advance they had made in making the consensus comfortable with space travel was reversed when the Challenger shuttle exploded, and mortals so turned their back on space that paradox became more of a problem. They make reference to a figure called Catherine Nichols leaving, which they don't quite describe what happened necessarily there.
No, Book of Worlds, there's a section on technocracy places out there, and there's this woman, former void engineer, who left, and she's saying, I'll give you the dirt on that stuff.
It is. Nice.
Okay, I'm not crazy then. I thought that was it.
Adam gets it in one. So once the dimensional anomaly hit, the general order was for everyone to come home. But the problem with that was that maintaining the safety of Earth requires continued monitoring and patrolling of space. We find out that during the dimensional anomaly, the Sentinel satellites that kind of serve as an early warning and probably defense system were completely destroyed, and that manual patrols were required for a fair period of time. And after the history section, we get a information on external relations, a field guide to their relations with the other conventions. They mention again that bad things will happen if everyone else finds out what's truly going on out there. The iterators keep pushing for trips to Autochthonia, even though none have made it back. They consider the New World Order to be their real enemy. They stay because of how powerful they are, and that advancing their agenda requires connections. The NWO is pushing to repopulate Horizon. The progenitors are viewed as friends, and they say if there was ultimately a civil war that they would side with the Syndicate. They don't quite mention why. My guess is the fact that their stuff is very expensive, so you kind of want to go with the money people. And they also generally think that the Syndicate has mishandled commercial spaceflight.
Yeah, I think another reason they were referring to in this section of Chapter 1 was there are a number of people in the Void Engineers who consider the Syndicate to be more practical and less likely to chase off on some idealistic goal that's going to get people in trouble. That was the impression I got from reading that. It's like, look, we don't like these two groups, but if we got to choose one to listen to, it's going to be the Syndicate. They're less crazy.
Then they go through the traditions. They note that they are one of the only conventions that does not have a shoot or co-opt as the only options policy. And then it more or less goes through their relations with each. The first one is they're like, we don't have a problem with the Akashiana, mostly because we seemingly never run into them. And you're like, yeah, that scans. And like, they do mention, though, that they are butting shoulders as the Void Engineers become more centered around the activities of East Asia. It mentions that the Choristers are problematic because they often meddle with things they don't understand, and they sometimes need to be stopped. But on the plus side, sometimes you can slip information to them and they are able to deal with something, and they refer to them as frenemies, which they say there's a tradition that on shore leave that Void Engineers party with ecstatics. They mentioned that the Dream Speakers in general want the Void Engineers to be dead. They're referred to as keeping the Avatar Storm alive, and Umbral Murderers is how the Dream Speakers refer to the Void Engineers. And they're like, they don't really seem to like us. They really are buddy-buddy with the Euthanatos, which I kind of liked, where they're like, yeah, they control the safest launch window, Ravana's Navel, which was the area that was ultimately cleansed early on and revised, and was an area that seemingly did not have the Avatar Storm. It was somewhere in South Asia. I don't remember the exact location of it.
Bangladesh is what comes to mind. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Often lead void engineer expeditions into entropic space, which is to say the low umbra. They bring up the hollowers. They're like, they're not actually members of the traditions, but they have a lot of local knowledge. They mentioned that it's a not uncommon recruiting tactic that a hollower will see a void engineer doing literally anything and be like, I wish I had that degree of focus and purpose in my life. And the book's kind of like, ah, it's good to have goals, kids. And you're like, oh man, darned with faint praise. They refer to the Order of Hermes as dangerous but disciplined. And I think that's a good summary of the Order of Hermes for a certain value of discipline. They talk about how they understood that the Aetherites suffered when Victoria Station was destroyed. And then they kind of make an off note that are like, threat null seems to be particularly sensitive to their pseudoscience. So we may have them help us. And I just like the idea that you're like, oh, we have a new creature ahead. It seems to be unusually sensitive to bullshit. Dr. Spacetime, get on it. And you're like, righto. They refer to the verbena as disgusting as an unsanitary, which I think is like the best diss that we've really seen, where it's like, ooh. Like they get blood everywhere.
Yeah, most of, in all three editions, most of the mage books treat the verbena with kid gloves. And then you have this one, it's like, they're gross. It's like, oh, wow, that's new.
They mention that they generally get along with the virtual adepts, but the problem is the rest of the technocracy hates them so much that it's very hard to work with them. It then goes over other entities. It says that the Nafandi will frequently offer you help if you're in a tight spot in the other worlds. Never take it, and try and take out as many of them with you as you can. And then we get the possibly single coolest side reference that exists in all of Revised that does not involve hyper-intelligent dolphins. When they make mention of, yeah, we disproportionately go marauder, but we still have their uses, and people call us the Mad Convention. And it has this paragraph that says, it mentions that they have programs to help people prevent enlightened madness, and they make mention of the Descartes Facility for Mental Health, and they say, when that fails, those who maintain a thread of lucidity are invited to join Captain Philip Broughton's Sidereal Strike Force. And then in parens it says, practice this phrase, an all-marauder strike force? What? That would be crazy. We'd never do that. And I'm like, yes, that, for days, please, we need to resurrect Revise so we can get that book. It then talks about vampires and has the most concise summary of my thought of vampires that exists within the World of Darkness. Jesus fucking Christ, won't these assholes die already? That is me quoting from the book. It talks about how there's been an increase in werewolf activities, that they're like dream speakers, but with claws. And I'm like, that's giving a lot of credit to werewolves. It talks about dealing with post-life entities. I don't know if this was a tongue-in-cheek callback to fairies, where they're like, don't engage with them because ammo's not free, but they tend to avoid us, which I don't know if that was a throwback to first edition, where they were considered to be like fairy infected people who wanted to blow up the moon. They talk about hunters. We get our first reference to demons and mummies, I think, of the Revised convention book. So take a drink. And then the last line is, threat null, nuke them from orbit. It's the only way to be sure. And that brings us to the end of chapter one. Adam, what'd you think of chapter one?
Yeah, which is a threat to Sigourney Weaver's Aliens movie. There were a number of references to American sci-fi movies and a few novels, but mostly movies. I was counting so many different Star Trek references. Like in the glossary, they said when you're crawling around in odd, uncomfortable places, that's Jeffrey-ing. Yeah, which is a reference to the Jeffrey tubes in, I think it was Star Trek Next Generation. And those, of course, were named after a guy who was a special effects guy who was working on the original Star Trek show. Jeffrey was either his first or his last name. And he would get these giant cardboard tubes used in putting in concrete columns and construction sites. And he would get empty ones of those, and he would just put them in front of the camera and tell the actors to crawl through them and say, yeah, that's going to be a crawl space and inside the guts of the Enterprise. Going back to the history section, I thought it was so cool to have this idea of derelicts floating in space waiting for people to claim. Some of them have usable technology. Some of the ships might even fly. Some of them have terrible enemies lying in wait. I mean, really cool stuff there for me to think about. They say that during World War I and World War II, they were having space wars in orbit with the Nafandi. Maybe that's not 100% reliable, but darn it, that sounds cool.
Yeah.
I want that in my mage games. Just,
it's too good to check.
Awesome. It's like World War I, 1917 or 1916 or something. It's like, yeah, I just got back from orbit. We're fighting Nafandi. It's like, okay, yeah, I'm using that. Coming back to page 24, there was sort of a criticism of how bad it was that the U.S. and the Soviet Union were in the space race competing against each other. And I don't know, there were some negative aspects to that, certainly, but I just think the competition and rivalry aren't always bad. This seems to be a pretty negative view of the matter, but I will admit it wasn't all kisses and roses. Coming back to the end of the chapter, the external relations, it had a section for each of the other conventions in the technocracy. I thought all four of those write-ups were absolutely brilliant. I thought it was insightful. It was interesting to read. It was useful for storytellers. It was just so well done. Definitely kudos to that. Going through talking about the different traditions, it talked about how they are cooperating with the Euthanatos. And it mentions that again later in the book. And I can see how there is a benefit to each side from that cooperation. And I can see how story ideas can come from that. But what I have a hard time seeing is how that cooperation would come about. It just really looks like both of those groups would look at each other and go, no, I don't want to hang out with them. So I don't understand how that started, but I can see the benefits of it. I like the attention paid to the Nafandi in these final four convention books of Revised Edition. Most of Revised Edition didn't even really mention the Nafandi. They sort of faded into the background. Even Satiros Brocato has mentioned that in interviews. And these four final books are saying, no, the Nafandi are out there. They are definitely a problem. We got to watch out for them and, you know, give some ideas of what specifically the Nafandi are doing. I thought that was just awfully cool. But hey, I'm ready for chapter two.
Chapter two. More importantly, either chapter two opens or chapter one ends with probably one of the best pieces of technocracy art that we get. Action scientist on page 32 that says, this scientist is doing his part. Are you? Enlist today. I have this in t-shirt form. This is available on the Onyx Path Redbubble store. I find it interesting that it is censored on the Redbubble store because it shows someone holding a gun. I'm like, okay. Chapter two is entitled For All Mankind, goes through how the convention operates and opens with the line, we're pretty effing awesome. Again, that's just me quoting from the book. This book is full of gems of writing without getting too purple. Everyone within the organization gets both a strong military education and a strong scientific education. And it kind of talks about in the military ranks that there are two lead groups. The Marines are the leading edge of the hostilities, and the fleet operates universal craft. Universal here is capitalized, so I presume that's going to be a term of art describing just what they refer to their enlightened ships as. The Existential Threat Directive now leads with a firmer hand than Desitsi and Tycoides did. It is not uncommon for them to get involved in the operations of a single vessel where necessary, or a single co-op, a group doing mundane research. Each installation is headed by a commandant, and power flows from them. They don't bother listing ranks, which I think is fine. That's up to you to add if you want to. They then go through the civilian roles that they have within the organization, that explorers are hands-on as regards inquiry. They generally have open-ended mandates to explore something. Investigators have a clear line of investigation. Technicians act as assistants. Each of the mundane activities or each of the non-military or civilian activities is overseen by an administrator that has kind of a clear line of command. The researchers are those who stay home and provide essential reports. We also get a bit of information on page 35 of awards that you can get. It mentions that the roles people have are simply temporary assignments, that it's not one of those things where you would just say, I'm a researcher. You may move back and forth between things. The recruitment process kind of stems from a few different things. They pull technical and engineering fields, as well as anyone who seemingly has an itch to explore. It's also noted that they have agreements with a number of military facilities around the world that they get to pull a few recruits each year for their projects in exchange for providing technical and advisory assistance. And I thought that was a flavorful and interesting case of explaining where the Void Engineers may interface with the mundane world. They also mentioned that 1/3 of recruits found the Void Engineers. They send them off to make sure that they're mentally acceptable, and almost all of them come out clean. They say 49 out of 50. Then they introduce an interesting idea that to me harkens back to 1E. They refer to primal harmonics, which is to say curious people seek out curious people. And this was an idea that Adam has made mention of in 1E, that mages tend to find each other through any number of means. The core values that they have are of curiosity, fortitude, and know-how. And this is interesting because unlike other groups that list these, there really isn't an internal tension between those three. Like in a lot of the other ones, it would be things like, you're being appraised on your ability to follow the rules, also break the rules, and you're like, oh, that's going to be a tough one. This section also includes one of the few typographic errors where they do CO2 and they put the two with a superscript rather than a subscript. This is mostly me proving that I did my homework. They also go over how their violations are treated. Since they go through a deprocessing process, they never hand people over to the New World Order. If someone is exhibiting difficulties with mental health or mental instability, they have the Descartes Institute of Mental Health. Where possible, they try and deal with threats internally where they can get away with it. Often, though, it comes down to them needing to possibly kill another void engineer once they have touched something that they cannot return from. And then the next section is methodologies.
I thought this was a really successful example of converting an idealistic convention into an action-oriented convention. I was reading through this and I was like, yes, this fits. This makes sense. This can work well in a game. They are no longer the idealists, you know, mostly civilians with a bit of military. Now they're mostly military with a bit of civilians. It's like they say this is how we are in the introduction, and then in this chapter two, they really show how they've done it. And it works. I'm sold on it. I had my misgivings when I was reading the intro, but here it's like, no, you convinced me. I can see this. And of course, Void Engineer medals that they give to meritorious members. I thought that was a nice bit of flavor. It's one of those add-ons where it's really not necessary to anything, but storytellers can take that and use that well in certain scenes of their games. And so I really enjoyed seeing that. But yeah, let's take a look at the methodologies. There were five basic high-level methodologies in the first Void Engineer book, which came out in second edition. And we see those five groups here. They're handled a bit differently, of course, but let's get into it. We start with the Border Corps Division. They patrol space near Earth to detect and eliminate threats such as Nefandi, Marauders, aliens, and anything else that could threaten Earth's safety. Many of their members act as soldiers and are called Marines, but they are trained scientists, so don't underestimate them. They handle security for Void Engineer locations on Earth and off. When the Order of Reason had their convention of the Ivory Tower, the bodyguards and soldiers who accompanied the Seekers in their explorations across the globe organized so they could assign troops to protect new ventures. When Queen Victoria reorganized and the technocracy started, they took the name Border Corps Division. For years, the Marines didn't need scientific expertise to perform their missions, but after the dimensional anomalies, scientific training and ability are a must. This group gets a larger portion of the convention's budget in recent years because of the increased threats. There are five internal divisions. Near Orbit Picket protects the skies from threats trying to enter Earth. Biospheric Space Garrison operate out of, let's see, 6 out of 9 of the surviving facilities originally built for the progenitors, but now militarized. They fight strangeness that breaks through the gauntlet on Earth. A Mirror World Patrol matches Everett. They watch the Everett volumes, which is another way of saying alternate Earths, for travel in both directions. They stop threats from reaching our Earth and stop harmful mages from our Earth from menacing the other Earths. Space Combat Patrol protects Void Engineer facilities in space with fighter craft. Delta Teams are elite Marines that operate for weeks at a time in hazardous locations. The BCD is the most respected methodology by other conventions in the technocracy. Earth Frontier Division explores the unknown places remaining on Earth, from the deep sea to remote wildernesses and underground. There are even a few mysteries hidden in urban areas. The EFD is the modern incarnation of the Seekers of the Void that join the Celestial Masters to create the modern Void Engineers. They are mindful of the mistakes of the past and try to help the people they encounter in remote places. There are 7 internal groups. Aquatic exploration teams explore the oceans. They're undersea constructs that have been so useful to the other conventions that they are the largest and best funded of the EFD's internal groups. Cryogenic specialists operate in the Arctic and Antarctic. They are frustrated at the number of dimensional phenomena disappearing in recent years. Hydrothermal botanical mosaic analysts work closely with progenitors in rainforests and swamps. Inaccessible high-elevation exploration teams explore remote mountains where gates to otherworldly places still exist. Subterranean Exploration Corps explores underground and have a lot of data on past discoveries. Maintenance and Custodial Division maintains all Void Engineer-built constructs on Earth. The newest group is the Incursion Quantitative Analysis Team. In the past 3 years, the dimensional anomaly has been extending its harmful influences to Earth. The IQAT is doing all they can to solve this. Because the members of other conventions encounter the EFD more than the other methodologies, the EFD acts as ambassadors to the rest of the technocracy. Some have noted tensions between the EFD and other methodologies which operate in harsher environments. Naturalization Specialist Corps are a second line of defense to handle threats that break through to Earth. They started as the Office of Entropic Space Affairs inside the Border Corps Division. After World War I, the number of threats increased dramatically, so the NSC was born. There are three internal groups. Interface Defense Corps handles threats that get past the Border Corps Division. They operate a massive network of satellites and sensor stations. They also handle breaches in the gauntlet from Tradition Mages and other deviants. Spectral Neutralization Division handle threats of entropic space, what most people would call ghosts. The Descartes Institute of Mental Health provides mental health services to void engineers and other technocrats. They are the key to the convention's resistance to the New World Order's subtle control. Members of the NSC often work with New World Order agents and must be careful about their resistance to the other convention's mental techniques. Pan-Dimensional Corps explores the deep universe, continuing the convention's tradition of extending the final frontier. They also assist other groups in the technocracy closer to home with surveillance and security. The PDC started when Tychoides began explorations through the gauntlet. It got its official name when Queen Victoria conducted her grand house cleaning. After the dimensional anomaly, they have grown to resemble a space navy, as exploration has mostly given way to defense. There are five internal groups. Fleet Operations Command is the largest internal group. It operates the ships that handle hostilities in space. Void Construction Corps builds spacecraft and repairs the near-universe constructs still in operation. The Intelligence Directorate monitors the deep and near universe. Cybernauts handle the digital web. Chrononauts take great risks to explore time. Research and execution mostly remains on Earth to develop new technologies, make scientific discoveries, and design new equipment. Some members accompany groups in the field as engineers, specialists, etc. The Celestial Masters of centuries ago developed star charts, telescopes, and other equipment to aid their work. Their efforts are continued today by research and execution, which gained its current mandate in the Grand House Cleaning with some input from Tychoides himself. There are four internal groups. Vessel Construction Corps produce spacecraft in undersea shipyards. Advanced Research Division researches and tests new scientific devices. Field Engineering Corps provide engineering crew for ships and constructs who know how to fight. Fleet Intelligence Service analyze information coming in from all fronts. Their primary offices are in the undersea Yamaja Station and the new Copernicus Station. Their field agents wear black and have tight lips. The brief summary of the five methodologies on page 38 is very useful to storytellers. Less than a page and it hits the high notes. I complained about groups internal to methodologies in the Syndicate Revised book, but here they justify themselves. These internal groups make sense and add something to technocracy-focused chronicles. So definitely a thumbs up for me.
I will now state my criticisms. I have stated my criticisms. The thing that I thought was kind of interesting is, as you had mentioned, that the group that is most respected internally to the Void Engineers and the group that is most respected externally to the Void Engineers are two very different groups. And I kind of found that fascinating. Later on, for instance, they introduce an R&E character that says, this is a person that people name their kids after, which is a figure of speech that's used in more than one occasion in here that I certainly like. I also like that they fully recognize the history of the Void Engineers. They make a lot of reference to the Quila Machinae, and as opposed to making them just this monolithic thing, they talk about the different classes eventually. And this is something that's just woven throughout. This book is unusually internally consistent. And I don't know what it says that I need to point that out. That it's like, oh, they did a good job making things sure things were consistent. Yeah, I like to.
But to back that up, in some of these other convention books I'm reading through and I hit a passage like, oh, wait a minute, what?
Yeah.
In this book, I didn't have any of those moments. It all clicked.
I like that the BCD mentions that the near Umbra has gotten a lot weirder. They open up a lot of space, that they mention that things leak through and survive reentry, that they are loved in other groups. The Earth Frontier Division talks about exploring semiotic spaces. And I thought that was cool, which is to say they explore mythical locations and make sure they're safe. And they make the example of Fiddler's Green. They introduce and the dimensional anomaly incursions, that the idea that there are places where the dimensional storm breaks through and something weird happens. They also mention that they are diplomats, and I like that they're like, there are diplomats, and the person depicted on page 42 holding up a small biosphere with very pronounced pit stains that appears to be sweating or alternatively have advanced acne, I'm like, yeah, okay, I could see why other conventions think you're weird. This is something that we also got from the Akashiana group, where it mentioned, hey, this group of like ancient Sifus tends to do the diplomatic stuff, which is why people have this impression of us. And they kind of did the same thing here, that they're like, hey, people view the Void Engineers as being useful, mostly because when they encounter other people, in a lot of cases, it's someone who's only exploring Earth. And they're like, shouldn't you be out there, I don't know, shooting things? I also like the fact that they repeatedly make mention to Chrononauts and Cybernauts. It gives you enough information that you can add it if you want, but not so much that they explain away something that's cool. Chapter 3 is entitled Forged in Smoldering Stars. And this is a deep one. It talks about Tycoidean cosmology. And this is a section I read a couple of times, so hopefully I do it justice. And it more or less says the universe instantiates all computable models to the extent of their completeness. That ultimately requires a little bit more information later, but that the universe itself is a device that has infinite computing capacity, that they refer to it as a hypercomputer. Everything that can exist does, but its degree of existence is determined by its provability as well as the thought that generated it. So this is this interesting combination of completeness, almost in the mathematical sense, as well as kind of Platonism, that all ideas are out there and exist, but only those that can maintain themselves get instantiated. It then later talks about how all sentient and sapient creatures have the ability to help instantiate reality, that these elements of reality, which are ultimately computable, is done by something they refer to as the prime element, which is the basic unit of computation in the universe. It basically says that there are laws of physics that kind of provide a foundation of reality, and that once an area develops to the point where it has entities that have some sort of sentience or awareness, that it's their sense data serves as a way of reinforcing that reality. But once you get sapience, the ability for self-reflection and thought, that those entities have the ability to generate new models. And those new models allow for magic, more or less. It says that very few people are capable of generating a sufficiently consistent model that reality will observe it. And only by there being so many people does humanity generate the physics that allows it to survive in its modern form. I think this was an improvement on the model that we got in Society of Aether. I think it did a good job of updating that, and it answers the question that I always had that says, so what's so special about the technocracy paradigm? And the statement more or less is the fact that it tries, unlike a lot of other paradigms, to be rigorous and internally consistent. And that is kind of the power of it. On one end, it makes it less likely to violate the laws of reality. On the other end, it may hem you in a little bit, what they refer to as the enlightened anthropic principle, that any model of reality that can be sufficiently instantiated within the mind of a person can be instantiated in reality. And a lot of other paradigms simply aren't, for lack of a better term, thought through enough to exist. And at least that's what kind of they say is what makes the technocratic view of the universe special. It then, and I'm like, okay, that's a cool idea, that's fine. But it then goes on to say, when contradictory ideas clash, one wins and becomes reality, and the other gets shunted to the Umbra. So it kind of refers to the Umbra as this graveyard of ideas, and then it looks through the world around us in terms of this model. And it says that biospheric space goes to the edge of the atmosphere, and it is the extent of non-intelligent life's limit. It is the furthest that the very bugs around us have the ability to kind of harden reality. The spatial horizon is the mass's limit of control and contains what they refer to as conventional space. It gives a neat little map of where that ends. And that is suggested to stop around the asteroid belt. The digital web is created by the instantiations formed by artificial data structures, which I like because it makes the digital web special, as opposed to just being another area in the Umbra. To say that enough complexity and data creates its own anthropic field, creates its own reality, I think is interesting and makes the digital web unique in a way that's, it is neither a discount Umbra nor just a way to go into a computer a la Tron. It then walks through the different layers. It refers to the High Umbra as Ensemble Space or the Astral Realm and contains fundamentally mathematical objects. They make mention to the philosophy of Max Tegmark, which I will include a reference to it in the show notes, which is a fascinating but I don't think entirely complete view that essentially says that mathematical objects are real, and that is a layer of reality unto itself. The problem with that is Tegmark never provides a good definition of real, but that is beyond the scope of this. They refer to entropic space or the low umbra, which is where memories of objects go when they are being broken down after they have been modeled. They also refer to biospheric space, which is the middle umbra, and is generated by the belief that we have that objects have spirits. So more or less, the middle umbra is created by the belief in spirits are created by a belief in spirits. It suggests that something odd happened in the digital web, that they thought that the Void Engineers and the Virtual Adepts were going to be the group that acted as gatekeepers until the NWN Syndicate chose to take advantage of it as a medium. It refers to the area between the two horizons as subspace. It also talks at length about Everett volumes, which are just another term for the mirror zones. And it says, are we but a mirror zone of a larger reality? And it says, probably not, because no one's been able to do it yet. It still privileges our reality. It doesn't prevent you from positing that we are just a mirror zone embedded within something else, but it does give you a clear idea that other dimensions, that we are special compared to other dimensions. We are not merely Marvel's Earth 616. There is something special about us. It then goes on to give more information about the dimensional anomaly, history of what was lost when, how the satellites were occurred, the jump gates that were broken. If you have a group that wants to focus on that or the Fallout format, this is a pretty good detailed section of that. It then also gives information on the Quantum Voyager merit, which is the Technocracy version of the Storm Warden merit. And it makes an interesting observation that they are secret, as in it is not, there is no central list of where these are that is available anywhere. Also that crews will defend these figures to the death. I very much like that, because in technocracy games, you very rarely have the idea of a chosen one, that someone in and of themselves has some special attribute or feature that makes them special. But here we get that, if that's the kind of narrative that you would like. Also the idea that there is some guy located on subdeck B that allows this whole crew to survive, and that everyone will defend them to the death, I think is pretty fascinating. The next section is entitled Points of Light in the Void, and it goes over some things that are still left in space. It talks about how the Copernicus research station, the Dyson Sphere around a distant star, was raided by the Nefandi in 71, and they broke two of the stellar drives. It has now collapsed into a black hole. It talks about the Vivo, the living ship that caused the Tunguska event that was located in the early 20th century. They talk about how the New COP is a training place for Umbral expeditions. It doesn't quite give a location for that, so I assume space, but I don't know. They talk about how Darkside Moonbase, the half that was destroyed, was during a slave rebellion. I don't recall that being a previously established fact. And then it walks through the quantum dimensions, what it refers to as the Shard Realms and Shade Realms. And I was pleased in that I can never remember the difference between which one is the Shard Realm and which one the Shade Realm. And likewise here, it's just like, ah, I don't remember which is which. We're just going to keep going through. They talk about how Mus, the moon of Mercury that held a hermetic college until it was taken over by the Nefandi, is hotly contested. Venus is full of marauders. The moon varies wildly depending on who is there. There were gas mining operations on Jupiter. We get information that not only are the planets sometimes hotly contested, but in many cases, so are the moons. It just mentions that there's something on Titan. And I'm like, yes. It mentions that Senex, the current leader of the Euthanatos, allows no traffic onto Pluto or its moons. And either this is a professional courtesy, a statement of disinterest, or an observation that in a fight between a void ship and Senex, you should put your chips down on Senex. And I am fine with all of those options. It talks about how the Kuiper Belt, the area containing Pluto and areas beyond, contains weird objects that were ejected during the dimensional anomaly. And then we get to what is essentially the crux of this entire book, that everything else is just kind of wrapped around, information on Threat Null. The high-level overview is that the Threat Null was coined in 2000 when the Proto-Existential Threats Directorate worked to make sense of three different incidents involving ships beyond the spatial horizon. All of the high-level groups that were cut off from the from mundane reality, from the Mudball during the dimensional anomaly, eventually suffered from void adaptation, what we would refer to as disembodiment. They lost the ability to return to Earth. They became spirits. In the case, though, of the technocratic versions of this, whether it be control or the administration or any of the other higher ups within the group, the inner circle or what have you, they were very potent and they still have access to the conditioning that grants them the ability to control conditioned technocrats. And now these inverted spiritual reflections have kind of gone through this weird temporal speed up where they've seemingly gone through centuries of development in some cases in the previous 10 or 15 years, and that they have reappeared and they are possibly making moves to invade Earth. We are introduced to the Autopolitans, which are the mirror reflection of the Iterators, who are slowly taking over Autochthonia, which has undergone an explosion of life and development. We get the Agents, who are the mirror of the NWO, who are just absolutely amazing infiltration and subversion agents. We get the Transhumans, who are the progenitor analog, the transhumanity. They seem to be similar to Autopolitans, except for being biological, and they are just kind of a hive organism. And then finally, we get the Residents, who are the reflection of the Syndicate, who insinuate themselves into umbral courts and strive to subvert them, and that they have been making a ridiculous amount of progress. They make mention that the Residents have been causing wars between different elements within the Tapestry, and Threatnell is set up as being the group that everyone needs to worry about. It is suggested, though, that since they have the ability to co-opt conditioning, that only groups that have gone through deprogramming have the ability to interface with them. So the idea would be, if a regular technocrat who hadn't gone through deprocessing were to expose one of these, Threatnell would still be able to trigger that latent conditioning and co-opt a member of the technocracy. So the reason no one else can know about it is they quite simply don't have defenses against them, that they would, Threatnell considers itself to be the true technocracy. And I have talked a lot. What did you think about chapter 3, Adam?
Yeah, chapter 3 was not the longest chapter in this book, but it was, in terms of content, it was quite heavy. You spoke about the enlightened anthropic principle they mentioned, which is basically void engineer paradigm. I really like this kind of paradigm thinking. I rarely see it in any edition of Mage, and I really enjoyed it here. It flowed nicely into their cosmology, of course, is a formally recognized skill in the Mage rule system. And they call it the Tycoidian cosmology, named after Tycoides, their former great leader who made a lot of scientific accomplishments for them. Really nice cosmology. I think it wraps things up very nicely. It explains things. Of course, when talking about the Void Engineers, their focus or specialty sphere is dimensional science, which is the technocracy term for the spirit sphere. So in the game of Mage the Ascension, that means the Umbra. This is the convention in the technocracy that deals with the Umbra. So if you're going to talk paradigm and their view of the cosmology of the universe they live in, you've got to factor in the Umbra, or you know, you're kind of missing the ball with the Void Engineers. And they do that very well here. This is why things, some things are in the Umbra, some things are in the actual physical world with us, and this is how things move back and forth. Here's some theory behind it. It fits, it works, it's interesting to read. As a storyteller, I would like to incorporate it into my games, so very good job here. It mentions that Iteration X is up to something on the digital web. I thought that was a cool idea. It mentions that you should require players to have the cosmology skill at level 2 before they even try to get into the Middle Umbra, or look into it, or put something there. And I think that totally makes sense to me. I think that, example, for a dream speaker, they don't have to have the cosmology skill to get into the High Umbra or the Middle Umbra. But for a technocrat to, you know, effectively deal with the Middle Umbra, yeah, they're going to need to have a few levels of the cosmology skill to take that very different area that is kind of outside of their conceptual model for the most part, and be able to do something effective with that. So that was a clever use of game rules there to support something. I really like the summary of travel rules that they wrapped up in a sidebar on page 56. Basically, if your mages are going to go here, these rules. If you're going to go over here, they're going to need these kind of spheres, these kind of skills. nice to wrap it up, and I thought it was reasonably thought out. Page 59, we have a new way around the Avatar Storm or Dimensional Anomaly. At the beginning of Revised Edition, they basically said, you can't get around the Avatar Storm, it's just too hard, and we don't want you to besides. And then later on, when Bill Bridges took over Revised Edition, there were two or three methods for getting around the Avatar Storm if you want to take your players into the Umbra. Here we have yet another way, which is really particular to the Void Engineers, and that is, see if I can remember correctly, when something gets through the Umbra, it leads through the gauntlet, it leads a certain kind of signature, and a void craft can detect that, and if it hits it at the right vector, it can break through there and get you into the Umbra. So I thought that was a nice detail for people who want to take their players in Voidcraft into the Umbra, which of course the tech actually has different names for. But the old Copernicus Research Center, which of course was lost in the Dimensional Anomaly, it says there is now a black hole there and something is leaking out. And I thought that was a cool idea. I realize a lot of people are going to read this and say, hey, look, black holes pull things in. They don't push things out. That's ridiculous. Well, yes, but I've been reading a number of science fiction novels that posit that craft in this universe can approach a black hole. They can get very close to it, but not close enough, not quite close enough to get sucked in, and they can get into this area that I think they call the event horizon, and that the laws of physics do work a bit differently there, and there's even some postulation that the right kind of technology could set up special conditions where large amounts of energy could be generated. So I don't think it's ridiculous to say that there's something in our universe that got to that black hole, took advantage of it, and then from there infiltrated out to cause trouble for mages on Earth. So I don't think that's ridiculous. I think it's a cool idea. They give some information on the old Copernicus Research Center. And as I was reading this, I was thinking, but this is gone. Why are you giving me so much information about it? But they tied it up nicely. At the end of that section, they said, we're giving you this history in case you want to write stories that connect to this, because there are still Void Engineers operating out in that area of space. And of course, there's the new Copernicus station, which is a different construct in space, but there are some connections in its history with the old COP. And so this is how you can take advantage of that as a storyteller, making stories for your players. So well done. It justified itself neatly. They give a sort of overview of locations in our solar system where you might take your players and what could be happening there. The moon, this planet, that planet, etc. And I thought that was very interesting. There were some neat ideas in there. I was kind of dreading it when I started into the sections, like, oh, they're just doing this because they think they have to and they're going to make every location boring. But no, there were some neat ideas there. So I liked that. The big idea, of course, is threat null, which when I first heard it, it's like the threat is null, so we don't have to worry about it. But I guess null is just a cool sounding word for a lot of people. Threat null was such a cool idea. As Terry said, the former leadership of the technocracy was way out in the Umbra and their orbital collectives and further out even than that. They were hit by the Dimensional Anomaly. They basically became Umbrood, and now they are taking advantage of the conditioning that most technocrats are subjected to, and they have this twisted idea that they are the true technocracy, and they're going to fix everything, and of course, they're going to have harmful effects. I thought that was a cool idea. It makes good use of the Avatar Storm that is such a big part of Revised Edition. It gives an outer space threat that is familiar enough and has enough in common with the technocrats to lead to a lot of interesting possibilities in your games. So that was very cool. The only part about threat null, which was a little odd for me, they took, other than the Void Engineers, they took the other four conventions, and they said this is the twisted version of them, and here they have their own name. The only one that kind of didn't work for me was the Residents, which is the twisted syndicate. It basically said there are guys in three-piece suits wandering around the deep Umbra, talking to Umbrood and becoming their counselors and, you know, pushing them to do things that help threat null. It's like, I guess I can kind of see it, but it just doesn't seem very interesting to me. The other three threat null groups, I'd like to use those in my games, but the Residents, I think I just leave them out. I can't see a good way to run with that ball. There was a translated Japanese science fiction novel I read called Usurper of the Sun by Kosuke Nojiri. It's put out by Heike Soru, which is apparently an imprint for some publishing company, the other website. We'll put something in the show notes for you. I mentioned this book because it is it's fairly short. It's one book. It's not connected to any series. And it incorporates some of these ideas that we see in Void Engineer Revised on Threat Null. For example, they talk about how Twisted Iteration X is using heightened nanotechnology to build constructs where different minds can form together into one physical unit and then break apart again. And they're doing odd things on other planets that technocrats are seeing through telescopes and the Void Engineers have to deal with. This novel brings in some of those ideas and gives some detail to it. So if you really want to do something with the Twisted Iteration X of Threat Null, I think there's some valuable resources there. So, Terry, let's look at chapter 4.
To me, the whole thing behind the residence is they wanted something that could be... So you have the agents which insinuate themselves into the Void Engineers, and I think they wanted the residence to be something that insinuated themselves into, like, Umbral hierarchies. So I like on one end that you are like, so who's that guy? He's like, oh, he's Yagalanak's PR stiff. Like, I like the idea that, like, one of the great old ones suddenly has, like, a PR department that that a resident is in charge of. It's later mentioned in future books that they've gotten so far as to be in the Astral Umbra as well. So they are active in the Umbral Courts, which is something we never really got before in terms of the technocracy being active there. And I thought that was interesting. And to the black hole thing, one of the problems that you have is anything that it posits that the technocracy has access to exotic matter, which would be matter that has negative mass. And once you do that, black holes are just kind of a playground. So have fun with that one, kids. And Charles Siegel and I talked about that one a bit when the episode where we talked about time travel and using black holes as kind of an excuse for that. And as a note, once you pass the event horizon, you go from having three spatial dimensions and one temporal dimension to having one spatial dimension and three temporal directions. Space is weird, kids. Chapter 4 is entitled Hangar Bay. This goes through the who and the what. It gives us three notables, Admiral Fu Hancheng, who is just a list of plot hooks with assistance and weird places causing time storms and is proven to be capable against the Nefandi. Ernesto Sanchez, a coordinated R&E, who is the head of a coordinated R&E attempt to save lives during the anomaly. He heads up a secret listening base. And then Catherine Nichols did early time research and came up with a way to defend against the global incursion of possibly something by creating a set of satellites that boost the dimensional anomaly, essentially kind of as a protective shield. As Adam mentioned earlier, was also the person that gave us information in Book of Worlds to explain a bunch of parts of space. And I think these are all interesting characters. They're perfectly good plot hooks that even if you don't use them per se, they're people that Void Engineers would be familiar with. The next set is Legends Among the Stars. The Anastasia, which was introduced in the first Void Engineer book, is out there. The crew is apparently dead, but it is full of useful devices. Dana Gardner is the kind of ambiguous character that we don't fully know to be Nefandi, but is spending time with Nefandi. Certainly that was the narrative character from the first Void Engineer book that was rescued by the Nefandi. She is nonviolent and weird, and this is one of the interesting cases where we have a technocracy thing that is kind of creepy as hell. And I thought that was kind of interesting. No one has been able to capture her, and she just kind of appears in places. There was one point where she appeared in Sao Paulo and just stared at a security camera for like 11 minutes, and you're like, well, that's creepy. We then find information about Station Yamaja and the wall being kind of this memorial to all those who were lost during the dimensional anomaly, and it talks about how spending time at Yamaja Station results in a slow change in resonance, and how it may form a spontaneous gateway if this continues for long enough to where they don't mention. They also talk about how reality is thin enough in the area that it may slip through the cracks of reality. And if it does, they're not sure what's going to be on the other side. It talks about Void Engineer groups, and it says there are a bunch of different Void Engineer chronicles that you can run, so make sure that you check with your group as to which one that you want. Civilian groups have different lines of commands, they have different rewards, military crews generally can't say no. Then they give you a fully statted out gunship and its crew. This is the Guanxi Yin, which is a void craft. And we get a lot of information on custom components. It talks about success costs, which will be eventually explained later. And then it goes through what it refers to as applied dimensional science. This is a pretty straightforward mapping of spirit as opposed to prime utility. There's not a lot that's moved around. The key thing for me is that with Dimensional Science 4, you can now stave off void adaptation, which is to say prevent disembodiment, for a week by paying a point of quintessence, which more or less gives us the arbitrary ability to stay, gives us the ability to stay in the Umbra for as long as we want. I don't recall there being a traditional analog to this, which, if true, is quite potent. We also get Void Correspondence, which is not quite a different version of Correspondence so much as a modified chart that is used for certain types of large effects. And it basically says that when you want to get from point A to point B, the normal range chart is nonsensical if you're going through space. And it basically says the minimum number of successes are going to be a combination of the literal distance that you are going in terms of kilometers, whether it be within a kilometer, 5 kilometers, 200, 1,000, 500,000, or 150 million. It kind of ramps up real quick there, as well as what it refers to as quantum field resonance, which is to say sympathetic connection. The idea is it is easier to go to places that you have more directly mapped. So it mentions that technocracy constructs are and void ships are labeled and mapped to within an inch of their life, whereas all the way out on the other end, you have thing where it's like, yeah, we were able to identify it due to spectral analysis or its gravitational wobble. And this is just a useful chart to calculate the number of successes required to go great distances based on how much you know and how far you're going. We get a remarkably few number of devices, which I'm ultimately okay with because the book does a good job of giving you enough of a framework to explain how to make your own, as well as all the previous books that we've gotten. And the interesting one here is we get ionic cloth. This is, I believe, at least the third time that we've gotten a description of ionic cloth. And it talks about, yeah, this is a multi-area genius material and so on that void engineers have, but it also uses it as an opportunity to fill in void engineer culture, that it mentions that people like ionic cloth, but different crews have different ways of representing it, that it's hard to get, even though it is a zero-point device, and that it is common to take the ionic cloth uniform of a fallen void engineer and to cut it up into pieces and to use that as patches and to write the name of the fallen on it. And I just very much enjoyed that as a ritual. It does give you the systems for it, but in addition to that, it gives a lot of flavor. We then get procedures. It introduces the procedure checklist, which is Entropy 2 or alternatively Prime 5, and it quite simply prevents you from botching, which if true makes it one of the most remarkably potent things that we get in the game, and also explains how the void engineers are able to do massive extended roles if in truth it is able to truly prevent botching. It gives us a remarkably powerful rote in the form of coordinated fire, where everyone just adds together their dice pools if they're all shooting at the same thing. The big thing here is that reduces the likelihood of botching, and in many cases, forces effects have a non-linear effect that the more successes you have, the proportionately more damage you do at an increasing rate. So suddenly being able to roll 30 dice does two things. One, it helps deal with entities that have huge amounts of armor or premium or other magical defenses, and two, reduces the chances of botching. It is remarkably potent. Deprocessing, again, is not too interesting system-wise, but it does a good job of explaining things, where it says, we deprogram people by leading them through a number of disloyal scenarios. There's a variant that adds prime to make it more likely to succeed, and then we get a large section on what they refer to as the shipyard, which is on how to create your own void craft. This is a large extended action. It provides systems of how long things take. It breaks it down into individual components, so any given failure isn't going to be catastrophic. It talks about you can pay for this in cash, and it's like, yeah, for each background point, it costs about $10 million per success. And you're like, oh, okay, so the void ship previously mentioned costs about $5 billion. And then they later on mentioned, they're like, yeah, the smallest void engines cost $250 million. Quilla Machine clocks in at $7.8 billion. And you're like, ugh. So it is interesting in that it gives you both systems in terms of background points to build this, as well as systems in terms of if your characters want to do their own off the grid. And I think this is one of the few cases where Mage provides a good medium crunch system where it's like, yeah, if you want to build your own, you can do this as an extended thing during downtime. If you want to just find one, that's totally cool too. It goes through a whole bunch of different add-ons that can be included here. It breaks it down into individual sphere requirements. So if you want to add aquatic capacity, then you need a character with matter 4. If you need to add a particular armament, you need correspondence 2 plus whatever the weapon is. And it just really knits it together in a way that I found impressive, because things like that are difficult to come up with. We get a bunch of sample void ships, and then it gives an interesting aside on page 95 called Punch It, which it says, like, void ships are already optimized to do anything with them, it's remarkably difficult to squeeze any extra performance out of them, to the point that those procedures that would attempt to do that trash safety protocols and are automatically vulgar. Also, if you were trying to augment what you're doing with magic, it only works at the number of half successes. And this makes it a pretty gritty version of space combat, where like the amount of change an individual gunner can do is actually quite small. At the end of the day, you're kind of reliant on how good your ship is. I would consider the sidebar to kind of be optional depending on what kind of game that you want to run, but it certainly suggests that they are going for a certain kind of grittiness to say, no, at the end of the day, we are all in this damn ship, and there's only so much any individual technocrat can do to operate it in comparison to how large it is. We then get a number of character templates that are perfectly fine, and then we get the epilogue. What did you think about chapter 4?
Yeah, chapter 4 was the longest chapter in the book, so a lot of material here. I thought it was really interesting that the Void Engineers are maintaining the dimensional anomaly as a defense against Threat Null and possibly other nasty things out in space. That is, yeah, definitely a secret they would be keeping from the rest of the technocracy, because the rest of the technocracy are saying to the Void Engineers, hey, we don't like the dimensional anomaly, make it go away. And so the Void Engineers are saying, hey, you know, it serves a really useful purpose, so we're going to not only study it, we're going to strengthen it and keep it quiet. So I thought the notable engineers section was good and useful. It gives us some notable Void Engineers that are alive today, and they're interesting enough that there's a reason for your players to go want to talk to them and have some interaction with them. I thought the Legends section was good. You know, two pages in these later convention books are given to Legends, and some are better than others. This was pretty good. And I was pleased to see that. They have a section on a Void Engineer only Chronicle or a Void Engineer only Amalgam. I thought that was fluff. Fluff as in not useful. It took up space. It was not inspiring. No useful systems. The Sample Amalgam, I thought was interesting. Crew of a ship and the missions that they go on. I think that a nice way to make other things discussed in this book more concrete and you know, put a handle on it for storytellers who may be a little uncertain how to work with that. This is the most detailed spacecraft write-up we have seen so far in Mage. Of course, there are Aethership and Voidcraft in all three editions of Mage, but this is definitely the most detailed for people who like their science fiction games and really want to get into that. This spacecraft write-up lets you do that more easily. I thought there was a good translation of the five levels of the spirit sphere into dimensional science without changing too much how it works. There's just some light suggestions on how to do this a little different or that a little different. So it's not like they totally rewrote the sphere, but they gave a very different look at it in a detailed, you know, five-level look. So I was pleased to see that. Taking a look at the devices, there is the dimensional phase disruption emitter, which is a laser gun. And I thought that was quite powerful. If I'm going to put that into my games as a storyteller, I'm going to keep a careful eye on that and either take it out or tone it down if I have to. That seems like a gun that every player who wants to blow stuff up is going to be begging to get their hands on. I like the write-up on ionic cloth. I like the fact that they say, look, it's zero level, but it is valuable. And that means if your player wants a suit, they can have a suit. If they want 10 suits, then as a storyteller, you say, hold on, you can't have 10 of these suits. It basically says there's high-tech technomancy put into creating these ionic cloth suits. And what you as players and storytellers can do is use that as a justification for the technocracy sphere magic your players want to do. And so I think that that's, I don't think it's too vague. I think that is nice and helpful for both players and storytellers. So I was pleased to see that. They have a rote for teleoperate. It's basically using technocracy sphere magic to remote control a probe or a ship or a part of a space station. I think that's fine, but I would require appropriate skill use along with that. In the write-up, they just say, hey, if you've got these levels of these spheres, you can just do it. And I would say, no, that enables you to use the skills that you have. And if you don't have the skills to do it, then yeah, you're going to be in trouble. But again, this is a role-playing game, so it might be fun to have a scene where you one character can operate the gunnery pod but doesn't know how to do it and start shooting in random directions, and you know, hilarity ensues. Looking at the rotes section overall, it was useful, it was sensible. I think this rotes section is better than a lot of tradition and convention books we get. The ship construction rules. This was a bold move, actually. In storyteller games, there is a lot of focus on character, drama, emotional impact in scenes. And when it comes time to put in rules for, you know, random tables or crunchy rules for how to build this gun rather than that gun. There are a lot of World of Darkness fans who don't want to see that kind of stuff in their books. And so I think the writers of this book did take a risk putting this in, but I think it was a good idea. I think they did it pretty well. I didn't have a term for it, but when Terry said medium crunch, I think that's about right. There's enough crunch that you can do a couple of different things with this system, but they did not try to cover every possible eventuality. When you get into heavy crunch, you get into role-playing games like GURPS or Hero System, or maybe some people consider Pathfinder a heavy crunch game. And there are a lot of role players who are trying to get away from that, and that's what attracts them to World of Darkness. So yeah, a heavy crunch system would not have been a good choice. My criticism with this particular set of ship construction rules is they start out by saying the number of crew that are going to be on your ship is going to affect the size of the ship, the difficulty and expense of creating it. But then they have multiple ways of putting crew space on the ship. One is berths, which is basically, think of a cot that folds down from the wall and folds back up again when you're not sleeping. There's quarters, which is basically a room with bunk beds two or three high. And then you've got staterooms, which is one room maybe with its own small bathroom for just one person. And so by putting berths as opposed to staterooms into a void craft, that has differing effects on the expense and difficulty and size. And I don't think that was thought through pretty well. I can see a group of players taking advantage of that loophole by saying, hey, let's fill it up with berths only, or let's fill it up with staterooms only because it, you know, gives us the numbers like this. So I would like to revisit that and tighten up that. Also, they give the sphere requirements for designing each step of the ship. And I think that is interesting, but to actually build a ship and go through every stage of the process, you need to have so many levels and so many spheres that it puts it out of reach for a lot of players. So that's something that storytellers will need to think about. As we've said in the past, a lot of Mage Chronicles start out with good intentions but don't run for very long. And so a lot of players have a hard time working their character up to the point where they can use a lot of high-level magic. And if your players want to build a ship, as a storyteller, you're going to have to consider that. If I'm going to make use of this set of construction rules, I would read it over two or three times carefully, which is not hard. It's only a few pages. And then I would type up my own summary in a word processor and print that out for my use in building ships. I think every player or storyteller is going to need to do that on their own to make the system more practical in actual use at the gaming table. Later on, they give some example ships, and they give both the background points needed, and if you're buying it, basically, and the successes needed if you're going through the detailed construction process. And looking at the three different example ships, the ratio of background points to successes is not the same. And as a storyteller, that makes it hard for me to gauge how to convert from one to the other. And basically, at final summary is ship construction is so expensive that a storyteller is going to need to think about how they're going to work that in. Basically, my thought is, if the characters want to build a ship, that can be a lot of fun, but it becomes so expensive that technocracy leadership, and perhaps even the syndicate specifically, is going to consider that a lot of resources pushed towards the players, and so they're going to be watching them very carefully. And do you want that to be part of your game or not? As a storyteller, you're going to think those things through. I like the ship combat rules, even with some of the flaws I've pointed out. I think it's a good idea. They took a risk in putting it in there, and I think the risk paid off. We have template characters in there. My criticism is the first one is the ace pilot, which the hotshot ace pilot who takes crazy risks and makes people worry is a staple of science fiction movies and novels. But this particular template, it looks like a sleeper, not a mage. In fact, it actually, you know, says in this book that void engineers are taught a lot of science as well as combat and piloting skills. And in this template, it says this sample character hated having to study and didn't want to do it and just wanted to fly jets really fast and really crazy. And that's all. And so looking at this template, it's like, yeah, this looks like an acolyte, not a mage or a full-fledged technocrat. So that was my criticism with that.
The epilogue is a brief spurt of the characters previously listed. They're going over Mus. They encounter some traditionalists. There's the iterator on board who's like, we have to kill the traditionalists. And there's someone's like, that person just shot someone who is riding a dinosaur. They're okay in my book. And the line they more or less have is something about the Nafandi want to destroy reality, where the tradition are just arguing over who should be in charge of the, our beef with these guys is an argument over administration of the Mudball. Our problem with the other guys is they want to eat babies. So sometimes calling a truce on a policy disagreement to take down the assholes who want to rain death on all of humanity seems all right. And I'm like, yeah, that's a pretty good summary of how that works. And then at some point, we get visited by the Autopolitans, and the iterator's programming is activated. They are getting a firmware update, and they talk about how beautiful the code is. And then the character we are following simply needed to kill the iterator before they were absorbed by the Autopolitans, and then they make a hasty retreat. This is the only example we have of kind of describing what an encounter with Threat Null would look like, and I thought it was short and effective and knit together some information we already had about Mage, some of the major themes with the book, with a note of how dangerous things are, and that brings us to a big old character sheet. What'd you think about the epilogue?
It did a good job of taking ideas and themes from earlier in the book and including them, wrapping them up. For example, there were two or three places in the book where it said void engineers can't be idealistic anymore because there's so much danger that we actually have to kill our own members when they learn too much because we have secrets that are vital to keep. In this epilogue, they are working with a iterator that has been, you know, cut off from her comrades. And so at the end, she's starting to be tempted by Threat Null, and so she gets two bullets in the head. I was like, wow, that is grim. That is a grim look at things. But it does fit with the rest of the book. So this is, you know, not going out in left field. This epilogue really calls out the mental conditioning in the technocracy, which has been mentioned in past Mage books. But most Mage books, even convention books, either don't mention it or downplay it. And you know, some storytellers are going to like that. Other storytellers would rather push that into the background. I just enjoyed seeing more of the wild mage material that I'm used to from the past being mixed in here. I mean, when they come up against Threat Null and Nafandi, there's wild, crazy stuff going on. There's dinosaurs and old technology, you know, historical relic rockets being fired off, but they're actually effective weapons. And it's some of that crazy mixed paradigm stuff that on the surface looks silly, but when you actually get into Mage, it's like, no, there's justification for this. I liked seeing that in the epilogue. So that for me was the love letter to Mage fans that this book promised to deliver. So general thoughts on the book, Terry, what were your thoughts overall?
I thought this was quite simply one of the best Mage of the Ascension books we've ever gotten, and hands down one of the best in revised. It was rich. This may be tainted by not quite nostalgia, but the knowledge that this is the last book for revised, and it is well done, and it would be the last update we would get for the Technocracy for 8 years or whatever until Technocracy Reloaded actually came out. I thought it was an exceptional entry. It made the world bigger. It answered questions while introducing new ones in a way that I think gave storytellers a lot of space in which to play. There's a bunch of open threads I wish we could have gotten more information on. At this point, I almost want a revised convention book Iteration X revised, because the direction taken with these four convention books was different than where the Iterator book went. Like, the Iterator book walked, these books ran. Talking about an abundance of riches, it paints out the world in a fascinating way, and I just wish every book had the energy, excitement, and curiosity put into it that this did. Pulling off a shift in a group in a game like this, I feel somewhat comfortable in saying that this is one of the largest kind of shifts we have seen within a group. The only other one that kind of really comes to mind is, and I'm also biased in saying this, is we get some hints in M20 that the Virtual Adepts have suddenly become one of the richest groups in Mage. To me, is one of those things that can very suddenly change the nature, demeanor, and outlook of a group. I like the emphasis on you need to be capable, but you need to be able to work with your crew. The more I think about it, there's an interesting thing that happens with the void ships that at a critical point when you're building one, it is weird to pay for something that is essentially going to be the crux of a chronicle. If you get a device or a talisman that is of moderate point value, it is very easy for me as a storyteller. It makes sense for me to charge you, as it were, XP, because it is going to simplify future challenges that you will face. A void ship doesn't solve problems so much as just changes the nature of a chronicle. It's like your character's building a castle or getting a boat. You've gone from adventuring in one sense to adventuring in a new sense. So on the one hand, I'm like, yeah, these are good systems to explain this. It's difficult and hard. And on the other side, it's like, this is such a cheap sea change that it's fundamentally different. To me, it would be like charging a character XP to have a baby in game. Like, the game before and after is so fundamentally different. There's never a point where you're like, I will solve this problem with Void Ship. Void Ships have Void Ship problems. So that is something that, just from the nature of how RPGs work, I'm very much flipping that over in my head. I'm like, how does this? But regardless, as Adam said, it was a risk, and I think it was well executed. We get a piece of art from Leaf Jones that says Leaf Jones 95 on it at one point that suggests that there was some stuff that was previously maybe not used in a prior Void Engineer text or something that had to do with space. And I thought that was kind of interesting. We get a reprint of previous Leaf Jones stuff on page 60. When Adam and I talked about the first Void Engineers book, we said that it is fundamentally a group centered around guns and tubes. And you are not disappointed in this book for that being a recurring theme. Once again, that new Leaf Jones art, or at least I don't remember having seen before, is on page 37. I missed Vince Locke. Vince Locke is one of my favorite artists. I would have liked information on how large space battles kind of work out. That's kind of the only, it is suggested that they are constantly dealing with deep umbral entities. So I have the Void Ship side. I don't have the antagonist side. Like,
oh, what do the Void Engineers point their guns at?
Yes. For instance, previously they make mention that one of the Void Ships has had 12 encounters over the previous 6 years, or Darkside Moonbase was difficult to reclaim. I would have liked more information about the reclaim from what. I am fascinated to see a werewolf versus technocrats on the moon game occur. I just need a little more information on how to run that. The only area where it lets me down is things like that, where we're like, okay, so what are the space squids that these characters are going to go up against? And it is fundamentally different building an antagonist. Like, for instance, an alien, a xenomorph from the Alien series, is a perfect antagonist for a group of space marines. But once you have a Void Ship, like, you just, as it says, you nuke it from orbit. Some more space antagonists would have been great, but I imagine that is niche content. And again, this book already ran long, so I get it. If you're going to do anything in space, I have no trouble recommending it. If you want to look at a bunch of plot hooks for a rich, engaging way of looking at the technocracy, this is certainly here. It is certainly cleaved off from the other ones. Like, this book very much presents it as there are four conventions and then there are the Void Engineers. It is less interrelated to what's going on with the other ones. It feels more tenuous in terms of its relationships with other groups, but that's kind of the nature of the beast. And I am done gushing. What did you think about it, Adam?
No, I also really like this. I think Revised Edition ended on a high note. I think this book was well done. I was pleasantly surprised in a number of areas. The final four convention books have this idea of there's a coming civil war, and the two internal factions of the technocracy will be led by the syndicate on one side and the New World Order on the other. And, you know, this is bad because the technocracy might shake apart, or at least, you know, get involved in a useless conflict. And I think that dovetails very well with the ideas in this book of, you know, there's Threat Null. It's an outside threat. It's really bad. So when Threat Null moves against us, that would be the perfect time to not have a civil war. And so if you want to have a chronicle that really focuses on these, you know, final four convention books and deals with the technocracy's problems, then yeah, have a civil war start at the same time that Threat Null moves against all of the technocracy. And then you can have that tension of, we've got an internal conflict and an external conflict at the same time, and how are the players going to fit into that? Can you solve one before you solve the other, etc.? So I think that was more well thought out than I expected to find. So very clever there on that level. I just like the idea of, even if you're not dealing with the technocracy civil war, I'd like the idea of the outside space threat. I was surprised to see that in Revised Edition. It focuses so much on Earth and humans dealing with other humans and struggling for power. And then to see, hey, no, we're really going to look at space threat. There's more than one kind, and we're going to give you some details on them. I was surprised to see it, but I thought it was really cool and very appropriate for the Void Engineers. Terry had talked about how in these later books, every convention has a secret they're keeping from the other conventions. And I think that's a fine idea, and it plays well into the notion of the technocracy civil war. In this book, the Void Engineers have three secrets they keep from the other conventions. One is they're resisting the New World Order mental conditioning. Two is the existence of Threat Null, and it makes sense that they're keeping it secret because it is a threat that if the other conventions knew about, they'd say, let us look into this, and then they would be totally subverted by the mental conditioning and the temptations of newer heightened technology that Threat Null can offer. And so, yeah, totally makes sense. And number three was the Void Engineers have promised to eliminate the dimensional anomaly, but they are continuing it. And yeah, that is a secret you've got to keep from the leadership on Earth of the technocracy. So that was pretty cool. One thing that I would, as a storyteller, deal with in a Threat Null Chronicle is I need to answer the question, what is making the disembodied former technocrat leadership evil? I can see how they were disembodied by the dimensional anomaly. I can see how they would have a focus on Earth, but this book makes it very clear that they are evil and they want to do harmful, damaging things if they get their way. So I need to answer the question is what happened out there in the Umbra that made the disembodied technocrat former leaders focus on evil? What made them destructive and harmful? And of course, as a storyteller, it is your job to answer that question, and that can lead to interesting chronicles. This book had a big focus on alternate Earths, which has been covered in the past in Mage. The Book of Worlds talked about the Mirror Zone, and that is for storytellers who want to deal with alternate Earths and you know the fun that can come from that. A lot of storytellers can see how that would make their chronicle get very confusing and complicated very quickly. And so most Mage books don't mention Mirror Zone. They don't refute it, but they just don't deal with the issue. And this book like really focused on it because the Everett volumes, you know, they factor into the paradigm thinking about the Void Engineers. But it was just kind of surprising that there was so much repeated mention made of Everett volumes, which is, you know, Mirror Zone and Alternate Earths. Another thing to think about is there are a lot of Void Engineers on Earth. They live on Earth. They operate on Earth. It is a sizable percentage of the convention. If the part of the convention that is in space and dealing with Threat Null has to keep this a very tight secret, then that means there is a large number of members of the convention that are left out of the secret for security concerns. And if you have these two large portions of the convention that are not on the same page, I could see that causing more and more tension in the two groups drifting apart over time. And so in this book, that situation has not been in place enough years for that to happen. But I mean, if this continues out another 5, 10, 15 years, I think that would happen. And that would be something a storyteller would need to take into account. For the first time, I hear about the dimensional anomaly is extending its fingers and attacking Earth directly. And the other convention books make no mention of that. I guess that's more appropriate to the Void Engineers, but it's like taking the sample plot lines from the Ascension book and like resurrecting it again. It's like, well, didn't we cover this? Didn't we do this? It seems kind of odd to put this at the end of Revised Edition with these later convention books. I guess some people are going to enjoy that. It just seemed odd to me. When I look at all of Mage the Ascension as a game, I think it's really cool that a lot of genres and styles and elements are pulled in. You've got, you know, science fiction elements, classical fantasy elements, time travel, alternate dimension, etc. You get the idea. I try to shy away from letting my Mage Chronicles turn into science fiction games. When I have Voidcraft and Etherships and Technocrats and Technomancers, I try to have them rub shoulders with other kinds of mages to reinforce the idea that there's a lot going on here. This is not just a science fiction game. And so this book really ran with the ball with the science fiction idea, which is appropriate and it's cool, but I just like to bring in those reminders that the high-tech explanation for funny things you see out in the universe is not the only explanation. So I would try to bring in that larger perspective if I was doing a Void Engineer-focused chronicle. Even technocrats need to be reminded from time to time that, you know, they do have something to do with those oddball mages that they look down on, at least in my view. And one thing I'm wondering about is, when looking at the Final Four convention books, why did they focus so heavily on technocracy-only stories? I mean, I can see a lot of potential there and a lot of fun, but it just seems natural to me that there would be more thought given to the technocracy working against craft mages, orphans, tradition mages, etc. But these books really have a strong focus on technocracy having conflict with other technocracy members. And for me, when looking at revised edition as a whole, it seems that the authors make the assumption that the conventions operate a lot like traditions in the sense that they have less contact with each other, they keep to themselves more, and as a result, they are less influenced by each other's thinking, and they more easily fall into conflict with each other. I see in every edition of Mage the technocracy as being different from the traditions in that they mix together more. They spend more day-to-day time with each other. They have more philosophy and paradigm in common, and they spend more time with each other in their constructs and in the field. That makes it a little harder for me to, as a storyteller, to justify convention versus convention conflicts. Because even if the leadership saw an advantage to, you know, double dealing this other convention, their lower rank members are going to have more in common with their fellows in the other convention, so they might not go along with this scheme for, say, the New World Order to, you know, push out the Syndicate, you know, etc. So as I look back on all of Revised Edition, two things stand out to me. One is Terry and I have developed a sort of a gentleman's disagreement on the nature of Revised Edition, and that is, when I look at Revised Edition, I see so many things that make it not only different, but pronouncedly different from the two editions that came before. And so I see it as actually breaking away and establishing itself as a separate new role-playing game with its own themes, its own ideas, its own direction. And Terry, you know, reasonably disagrees with that. He has observed that all four editions of Mage have their own differences, their own outlook on things, and there isn't one of those four editions of Mage that really breaks away from the other three. I mention this not to be sour, but because I think it's funny. When I think of the first three editions of Mage as a whole, there is one low point of Mage that just stands out to me, and that was in Revised Edition. The Cult of Ecstasy Revised Tradition Book has a scene in it where two mages are sitting in a coffee shop, and the other, you know, the older mage is trying to instruct the younger on how to avoid paradox. And she gives an example of a use of sphere magic. She uses it to signal the waiter so that she gets her bill quickly so she can leave because she wants to get on with her day. And so she looks up and, like, you know, signals to the waiter and does a sphere effect to get the waiter's attention. Then she says to the younger mage, "Now you see, that's a clever use of coincidental magic. That's how you should use sphere magic." And I thought, oh my gosh, we have gone from mages building horizon realms in the void out of nothing to signaling waiters. At that point, I just wanted to, like, fold up the book and toss it in the trash can. But Terry said, "No, no, dial it back. We got some more books in Revised Edition. Don't give it up, Adam. Let it go." But Terry, what was your low point?
I'd rather not dwell on low points. I do think that there was a, kind of in a series, you get the feeling that they could have done a great 8-episode season, but they had to do a 12-episode season or a 26-episode season. There were parts that revised where you're in those middle episodes, you're like, oh, there's not a lot happening. And for me, it was probably the narrative and setting portion of the Hollow Ones book, where it is literally 2,700 words before we get to anything that is not just description of the world. It also contains the greatest paradoxical effect in all of Mage, which is a person who's working as a dishwasher who's able to afford a 2-bedroom apartment in any major city in North America, but we need not dwell on these problems. And just as a reference, when I was writing for Lore of the Traditions, we had 9,000 words for an entire tradition. So in comparison to Vita, spend 2,700 plus the prelude on just kind of establishing mood. I'm like, can we get to it already? Like, when are we going to get to the fireworks factory? But to your previous point regarding differences in editions, to me, Mage is so inconsistent over its whole that it is really hard to say this is the core of Mage and this is not. The core ideas of Mage, to me, are things about possibility and fragility, and every edition does that in its own way. I kind of want to do an episode on the gift of inconsistency, which is to say, like, once Mage has spread out to cover so much area, it is very hard for me to tell anyone they are wrong. And I think that is a gift to a fandom community. So yeah, and maybe one day we'll do a longer conversation, but I think Adam certainly summarized my view quite succinctly. I do think, as a note, Revised sometimes gets, we have to deal with the fact that Revised by the number of words was the largest edition. It is by definition going to explain the most, and some people don't like that. And just as a line goes on, it is hard to avoid filling in parts of the map, especially if people don't want them to be filled in. So just to be cognizant of that. The same thing happened with Exalted 2E as another edition where it just like it kept going. There were so many books. But I look forward to discussing M20 to see how the quote unquote love letter to the fans arrives after four books. Books that each started with a statement that this is a love letter to the fans.
Yeah.
I'm like, ooh, back-to-back love letters.
Well, here at the end of the episode, I had three story ideas focused on the Void Engineers and material from this book, so I was going to deliver that. Number one, Delta Team 5 of the Border Corps Division has been recovered. The morale boost to the Void Engineers is so great, leadership doesn't publicly voice their concerns. The players are dispatched to Olokun Station, a large construct on the bottom of the South Pacific, where Delta 5 is being debriefed to receive their mission report. When the players see the reserved battle-hardened commandos are jovial and boisterous, something isn't right. The Marines keep delaying their report and won't release the black box recorder from their dropship. The players discover the Marines are under the control of an entity from the deep universe. They've rigged the station's power plant to detonate if they aren't allowed to escape. Construct Security is ordered to kill the Marines, but the players learn the Marines have vital data on outside threats that cannot be lost. Maintenance and Custodial Division runs much of the base and will cooperate with the players. Can the players recover the data before a violent showdown? Can the players find a way to thread the needle between a demented elite commandos and a well-armed security force? Keeping their convention secret in the midst of a guerrilla conflict at the bottom of the sea will require more than they bargained for. Number two, during a patrol of Earth's orbit, the players receive a transmission from a shuttle making a forced re-entry over the Atlantic. The transmission contains a schedule for updating access codes at constructs around the world, locking out non-Iteration X members. There are also passwords to unlock the areas of the digital web where Iteration X has been hiding their activities. The players learn the Clockwork Convention has been testing new technology on the digital web to see if it works. Technology given to them by Autochthonia itself. There are plans to defect from the technocracy. The trail leads to the nanotech research facility at L4 orbiting the sun. This Iteration X space station has been talking to Autochthonia, which Threatnil has compromised. Autochthonia is offering the perfection of heightened technology and the perfection of the cult of the machine. The iterators can't resist. The players are nearest to L4, so they are sent to infiltrate. When they discover a small fleet under construction near L4, they know the clock is ticking. The players will have to use their skills and savvy to gather data and disable the iterator systems before the Void Engineers can send a real attack force. Number three, an Earth Frontier Division research group in the rainforest of the Congo has gone silent after disturbing transmissions. The players are sent with a neutralization specialist core team of jungle combat specialists and Descartes Institute counselors to find the researchers. At the trashed research camp, the players learn deviant mages drove the EFD team to insanity, then drove them into the jungle. As they search for the missing researchers, they discover the deviant mages haven't left. The deviants are taking desperate risks to defend a secret hidden in the jungle. The counselors will have to guard the combat team from mental attacks, while the combat team defends the counselors from physical attacks. In the midst of this assault, the players must find the disturbed researchers and get them home. Can they resist the temptation to uncover the deviant's secret? A mix of skills will be needed to get everyone home safely. Well, those are my three ideas. And Terry, was there a quote that stood out at, after reading this book?
I do. I'm going to cheat. And since this is the last one, I'm going to have two. One was during the introduction where it said, "Aw, that was so thoughtful of Iteration X," I smirk, as we run towards the fighting. How many hints did they drop about providing Marines for a mission to Autochthonia? Only half a dozen. Command's amusement is even drier than mine. They're learning tact, which is his own breed of unsettling. Zhao, you've only got an hour left in the launch window. Copy that. We won't take too long to lend a hand. And I like the range of moods that both of these pieces did. The other one was in the character templates. One of them says, "One deviant told me that I could take his life, but I could never kill his dreams." This is incorrect. The standard protocol for killing an RD's dreams requires two sniper spotter teams with premium hypervelocity weapon loads and an officer cooperating a hyperdimensional field generator. Let's practice now. And I'm like, That's my technocracy. It just reminds me of the Office meme where it's the literalist character where it's like, all is fair in love and war. False. The Geneva Convention bans many activities that are considered to be unreasonable during warfare. And I like that. I'd say, just for the sake of completeness, so what are we reading next, Adam?
We are going to look at the Mage 20 Quick Start, which I'm not sure if it came out before the Mage 20 core book, but it is many people's introduction to Mage 20.
That makes sense. You want to take us out?
Certainly. If you have something to say, please contact us at magethepodcast@gmail.com with your questions, comments, or feedback. You can subscribe to Mage the Podcast on iTunes, Google Play, TuneIn, and other aggregators. If you like the show, others might like it too. And if you leave a good review for us, then others will be more equipped to find us in their web searches, and we would certainly appreciate it. You can follow us on Twitter at Mage the Podcast. We're also on the web at magethepodcast.com. You can listen to past episodes, see the order in which they came out, and see the complete show notes that we prepare for you. This episode is thanks to executive producers such as Buck Farmer, Christopher Phillips, Jay White Widner, Alex, Anders S., Anon, Berto, Bo, Boogers, that is a lot of boogers.
It's six. Six of them.
Brad of the Blue, Bryce Perry, Dan Svensson, Dennis Osborne, Elliot Osborne, Garga Lenoir, George Lara, Guy Conan Stewart, Ia Bull, Isabel Castillo, Jason Kennedy, Jason Vines, Jason W. Briggs, Jeff Brin, Jenna F., John Magnuson, Josh H., Joshua Heath, Carl Halperin, Leslie Weatherstone, Matthew Prohl, Michael Kreddle, Michael Parker, Nibero, Neil Patterson, Nikita Klemenov, Oliver Schindler, Patrick Mulder, Ralph Scheinhammer, Ricardo, Richard Bat Brewster, Rob H., Ryan Hilton, Ryan Kendi, Samuel Tobin, Stephen Carton, Thrice Great, William Connolly, William Martin, and W. Starter. If you would like to become an executive producer for Mage the Podcast, it would help us keep producing episodes like this one. You would also become part of our own council to discuss upcoming projects. The link in the show notes will get you started. Well, thanks everyone for listening. Until next time, truth until paradox, baby.
Remember, if you're going now past the Umbra, to always be sure that your deprogramming has taken full effect. Otherwise, you may find one of the members of your group to be compromised by some entity that was cut off during the dimensional anomaly that is now trying to co-opt the entirety of the Technocratic Union. Bye.